Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At William & Mary, we believe today's business education needs to be more than just innovative. It requires a legacy of success, a focus on teaching, an emphasis on technology, and a practical hands-on approach. At William & Mary's Raymond A. Mason School of Business, our online, part-time, and traditional full-time graduate programs apply these strengths to provide the experience necessary to help you succeed. Visit us at chatadmissions.com to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 12th of May, these are our main stories. Russia will ease its coronavirus lockdown despite a record number of new infections. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson defends his plan to relax restrictions in England. And how are staff at the White House protecting themselves from the virus? Also in this podcast...
All of a sudden, South Africans are discovering the delights of pineapple, specifically for home brewing.
One of the toughest lockdowns in the world sparks a new alcoholic hobby. We start this edition in Russia, where 6 weeks ago, the president, Vladimir Putin, ordered a partial shutdown of the country to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Since then, the unemployment rate has risen, and so too the scale of infection. The country now has the fourth highest number of coronavirus cases in the world. But President Putin has announced lockdown measures will be gradually eased.
From tomorrow, the single period of non-working days for the whole country and for all sectors of the economy is ending. But what is not ending is the fight against the epidemic. Its danger remains, even in areas where the situation is relatively favourable and there are still only isolated cases of new infections. We must not allow a breakdown, a rollback, a new wave of the epidemic and the growth of serious complications.
Olga Ivshina is from the BBC Russian service, and she told me that lifting restrictions will not be straightforward.
Russia is a vast country and situation in various regions is dramatically different. For example, if you look at Moscow, it has almost half of all the cases in Russia. But if you look to some more remote regions, for example, island of Sakhalin in the Far East, they only have 38 cases, you know, for the whole island. Or if you look to Chukotka, it's 31 cases. So, of course, it's very much different. And restrictions were very much different, actually. In certain regions, for example, in Moscow or in Tatarstan, you had to send a message or get a special permission to get out of your house. In other regions, you know, it was just said that you need to stay at home, but you could actually walk in the street or go to the nearest shop or pretend you're going to the nearest shop without any special permission, which you have to apply for. And that's why the restrictions, since they were very different, they would be lifted very differently as well.
How are people feeling about being told to go back to work when the infection rate, if you believe the scientists, is still so high?
Well, first of all, you know, most of Russians still get their information from TV, and TV is mostly state-controlled. So today, Mr. Putin said that, you know, we had 6 weeks of self-isolation. During this time, Russian system of healthcare had time to prepare, and now, you know, they're prepared for the consequences. They're prepared to fight the virus, so it's more or less safe. That's what they say. But it seems that, you know, more and more Russians are just very much afraid to lose their income. Russian economy has been struggling before the virus. Now, even officially, the unemployment rate is twice higher compared to, you know, time before the quarantine. In certain cities, it's four times higher. And experts say that unofficial figures could be even higher than that.
Olga Ivshina from the BBC Russian service. It's been more than 24 hours since the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson outlined plans to ease lockdown restrictions in England, where the infection rate is declining. But many people were left confused by the new rules, including those tasked with enforcing them. Brian Booth is the chairman of West Yorkshire Police Federation, a union for police officers.
It's disgusting that we've not had any guidance coming out prior to that announcement or at the same time. All we're wanting is some clear guidance to go and do our duties in the public, and we're not getting that. It's my colleagues who are on the front line dealing with the COVID-19, not the politicians. And they're having to deal with the public. If it's not clear to the public what they are or are not expected to do, how can this be properly enforced?
Well, on Monday afternoon, Boris Johnson gave more details about the government's plan, telling people to exercise good, solid British common sense. I asked our political correspondent, Chris Mason, if the rules are now any clearer.
There's been this 48-page, 19,000-word examination of the British government's rationale. The British government's rationale for England, because elsewhere in the UK, in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, they are deciding their own loosening of the lockdown and have a more conservative position. They are maintaining the view that people should stay at home. But in England, as part of this strategy, there's three stages. First one starts on Wednesday. That allows a limitless amount of exercise. People can move around the country, around England, as they see fit. But the rationale from the scientific advisers is that spreading of the virus outside is much more difficult than inside. And also, if you're going to persuade people to stick to the rules over the long term, then liberalising them might make it more likely that people will put up with those rules that they have to stick by for some time to come.
The leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, criticised the Prime Minister's proposals, the quote, lots of questions, precious few answers. Does he believe that, or is he playing politics?
I think there was a gap. There was a gap where there was a clamour of for answers and a huge number of questions. And that gap came about as a result of the Prime Minister giving his address to the country 24 hours ago and it being around about 18 or 19 hours on from that before this document emerged and then the debate in the Commons that followed it. So into that vacuum fell rather a lot of questions. I think it's probably harder to make the accusation of the government that they are not being clear now that document has been published. Although, let's be frank, the reality of the loosening of lockdown, wherever it's happening around the world, is one of greater complexity than the slamming of it on in one go in blanket measures that affect everyone relatively similarly.
Chris Mason. Lockdown restrictions are being eased across other parts of Europe. People in France, Spain, Belgium, the Netherlands and Switzerland are being given greater freedoms, including the reopening of some shops, schools, hairdressers and restaurants. But there are concerns about the impact the measures could have after Germany reported an increase in cases of the virus just days after a relaxation of the rules there. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson sent this report from Paris.
Naima opened her hairdressing salon in Paris today for the first time in 8 weeks, with her appointments fully booked. Her customers might be desperate for a haircut, but Naima is more cautious about France's lifting of the lockdown. I'm scared, she told me, first for my staff and myself, but also for my clients. France is taking a detailed approach to easing its lockdown, with complicated rules for deciding which parks, museums and shopping centres can open across the country. On the Paris metro today, some lines were virtually empty, while others coming in from the suburbs were packed. Commuters now need a document from their employer to travel at peak times and can be fined for not wearing a mask. More generally, shops and primary schools can reopen across France. People can travel freely up to 60 miles from home and can meet friends and family in small groups. Similar measures have been tried elsewhere in Europe. Spain is now allowing half the country to increase the relaxation, with street cafes, museums and hotels able to welcome visitors again, though not in Madrid or several other regions. Germany, meanwhile, so far Europe's role model for managing the virus, has seen the transmission rate rise since ending its own much lighter lockdown last week. After weeks of confinement, freedom, Europe's most cherished value, is undergoing national clinical trials to see if it's a threat or not.
Lucy Williamson. New York, the US state hit hardest by the coronavirus pandemic, has also announced the first tentative steps towards ending quarantine restrictions. Governor Andrew Cuomo said some low-risk activities like tennis could resume and businesses like drive-in theatres could reopen. But he also said other states should resist pressure to lift lockdown restrictions unless they're certain it's safe to do so.
We are not at a point where government is going to solve anything, frankly. This is people who are solving the problem.
Well, in the state of South Dakota, two Native American Sioux tribes are refusing to remove coronavirus checkpoints they've set up on roads which pass through their land. That's despite the state governor saying the checkpoints are illegal. Richard Hamilton reports.
The two Sioux tribes say they're trying to screen vehicles and prevent COVID-19 from entering the Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge reservations. But on Friday, the Republican governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, wrote letters to the tribal leaders demanding the checkpoints be removed. She's a Trump supporter and has refused to impose a lockdown in the state, citing constitutional freedoms. I request, she said, that the tribes immediately cease interfering with or regulating traffic on US and state highways and remove all travel checkpoints. But the chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, Harold Frazier, wrote back, saying they would not apologise for being an island of safety in a sea of uncertainty and death. Here he is speaking to NPR.
We live in north central part of South Dakota. It's basically middle of nowhere. The nearest health facility is a three-hour drive in Rapid City, South Dakota, for critical care. There's probably about over 10,000 residents here that live on a reservation. So if we were to have a massive outbreak, you know, where are they going to go? We know that if it was to ever hit our reservation, it's going to be really detrimental to a lot of our people. We're definitely not going to back down. We're doing it for the right reasons, and we are doing it to save lives.
South Dakota has reported more than 3,000 coronavirus cases, and the numbers are rising. There's been heated reaction to the story on social media, with some citing historical precedent. An American law professor and former White House advisor Richard Painter posted this on Twitter. The biggest killer of Native Americans after the arrival of Europeans was not guns, but disease.
Richard Hamilton reporting. Quarantine measures in South Africa are stricter than in most countries, and for many people, having a stiff drink to deal with stress or anxiety is becoming increasingly difficult. That's because the sale and transport of alcohol has been banned during this pandemic. The measure has resulted in some health benefits, like reducing pressure on busy emergency departments, but small breweries and winemakers say they're close to collapse. Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
You want to slice the pineapples? Okay.
Yes. Again, 2 cups of sugar per litre. Don't peel the pineapples, you can cut them.
All of a sudden, South Africans are discovering the delights of pineapple, specifically for home brewing.
Fine is to give the yeast the surface area to work off.
It's not just the lockdown prompting new hobbies and a rash of online recipes like this one, but rather a strict ban on the sale of alcohol, now enforced nationwide for the past month.
When you go to these supermarkets, there are portions that sell liquor. They shall not. You shall not buy liquor.
The idea behind the alcohol ban was simple. Stop drunk driving, stop drunken fights, and you'll free up vital hospital beds for people with coronavirus. And sure enough, it seems to be working. Professor Charles Parry has been analysing the figures at South Africa's Medical Research Council.
What we've determined is that we're seeing about 9,000 less alcohol-related trauma admissions per week in South Africa because of the lockdown.
But enforcing this 21st century prohibition has not been so straightforward. The security forces here have been accused of beating, even killing people, as they patrol poorer neighbourhoods, hunting for any signs of alcohol. Crime experts like Gareth Newham warn that, as with America's prohibition a century ago, South Africa's crackdown is not only proving violent, it's also driving the alcohol industry into the hands of criminals. As prohibition drags on here, there have been several instances, like this one, of liquor stores being looted by the public. As for the alcohol industry, it's now urging the government to, at the very least, relax the terms of the clampdown.
My name is Piwe Ngusani Mawela. I'm the founder and brewmaster of Brewster's Craft, one of the microbreweries in South Africa based in Johannesburg.
Your brewery may not survive this, you think?
No, if it continues any longer, I see question marks around the continued future of the industry, especially the small craft breweries. I mean, the big guys can find other ways and maneuver, but we're going to feel it more as a craft brewing industry.
That argument that small businesses are bearing the brunt of it fits into a larger debate here about whether such a strict lockdown is doing more harm than good in a country and a continent that has yet to see COVID-19 infection rates at anything like those in, say, Europe.
It's been 10 minutes and you can see the yeast is already active.
So 5 days from now we can drink this.
Of course, that may change. The alcohol ban may be loosened in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, South Africans wait at home and brew.
So good luck, and may you all have a drink in their hand next week. Bye-bye.
Andrew Harding. Still to come in this podcast.
The pop-up restaurant called Table for One consists of a simple table and a single chair set out in a meadow surrounded by fir trees.
Creative measures to restart the hospitality industry while complying with lockdown rules. Let's turn our attention away from the coronavirus for a moment. The Iranian army says 19 soldiers were killed when one of its warships accidentally fired a missile at another vessel during a military exercise in the Gulf of Oman. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher told Razia Iqbal that the deadly mistake has damaged Iran's reputation.
What the state media in Iran has said is that there was a small support vessel which was setting up targets for one of these regular military exercises in the Gulf of Oman, and it didn't move away far enough or quickly enough and was then hit by a missile from a warship. A video has been posted by an Iranian media outlet showing what is supposedly the aftermath, black smoke coming out of the ship. There were reports that it had sunk, but it seems that probably isn't the case. There have been still photos, again, purportedly showing it being taken into a nearby harbour. But the loss of life, much higher than was originally announced. It jumped up to 19 after, through the night, saying one person had died. 15 sailors were also wounded. Two of them are in a bad state, reportedly. So, you know, this is a major, major incident for the Iranians.
And the Iranian armed forces, no strangers to accidents and error. Just remind us what happened back in January.
No, absolutely. I mean, back in January, when tensions between the US and Iran were at their absolute height, looked like there might be direct conflict between them, the Iranians struck back after their top general being killed by the US in Iraq. And in that melee, in that fog of conflict, a Ukrainian passenger plane taking off from Tehran airport was shot down. Everyone on board that plane was killed, most of them being Iranians or dual Iranian nationals. For a few days, the Iranians stonewalled, made out that what had happened hadn't happened. They weren't responsible. They came clean after a few days. That provoked immense anger and outrage, not just internationally, but also inside Iran. We're already seeing some reaction to this within Iran, with people there saying, you know, what kind of authorities are these? What kind of government is this that isn't able to handle these situations correctly? Remember, okay, Iran is leading a number of operations around the world, so this is very bad for its image inside and outside the country.
Sebastian Usher. In Afghanistan, the intelligence service says it's arrested the regional leader of the Islamic State group, Zia-ul-Huq, also known as Sheikh Omar Khorasani. And Barasan Etarajan has the details.
The IS leader was arrested together with his chief of intelligence and his spokesman. The group has carried out several deadly bombings in recent years, targeting the Shia minority and killing scores of people. A report submitted to the UN last year said Sheikh Omar Khorasani had been replaced by the central leadership of the Islamic State group because of his poor performance. This has never been confirmed. The Taliban are the main militant group in Afghanistan, but IS has been active in some parts of the country.
Our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Etarajan. Let's return to our top story, the easing of coronavirus lockdowns in nations like the UK and Russia, two countries whose prime ministers have been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Well, what's being done to protect those who work at the heart of the American government? The White House. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher told James Kumarasamy that all staff have now been told to wear face masks after two key members of staff tested positive.
There hadn't been that direction before. You didn't really see officials wearing masks. If you did, it was sort of sporadic. And people at the top, the president, the vice president, didn't wear masks themselves. They constantly said that they had recently been tested, and they are tested regularly and had come out negative. But now you've seen the inroads that the disease is making into the West Wing. And it's not a very glamorous place, actually. It's small, it's crowded, it's sort of like a warren of offices. One of Mr. Trump's top economic advisors actually said in an interview at the weekend, it's kind of scary to go to work. It's a small and crowded place. And I think especially Katie Miller, having tested positive, she is the spokeswoman for the vice president, but she's also playing a central coordinating role in the coronavirus task force. So there are quite a few people who would have been exposed to her, and the three top public health officials have gone into self-quarantine as a result. So this has shaken things up.
Yeah, and her husband's one of President Trump's closest aides as well.
Yes, that's right. So it is. I mean, it's hard not to see all these lines leading towards the president, and he himself. It's always bad timing, of course, but it would be bad timing at this time in particular for him because he's trying to focus the message on opening up the country for the economy, for people to go back to work and go back to shopping and so on. And the messaging this week is all about being prepared for the reopening, instilling confidence in people and so on. And yet you have one of the most protected complexes in the country showing that it can't keep people safe. How are regular people supposed to feel confident when they go back to work?
And it's also other members who are involved, officials who are involved in the response, the highest profile member of the response team, Anthony Fauci, the head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. All of them have come into contact, it would appear, with people who have tested positive and are in some form of quarantine as well.
Yes, well, because they've been working with Katie Miller on this task force, they have said out of an abundance of caution they will self-quarantine. They do say that they are low risk. They have tested negative, but they are being cautious. Essentially, they're following their own guidelines. All three of them will be appearing at a Senate hearing on the ways to open the country safely, and they'll all be appearing remotely. Again, not a very reassuring image.
That was our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher talking to James Kumarasamy. And the number of COVID-19 related deaths in the United States has now passed 80,000. After weeks spent in lockdown, many of us might be craving a meal out at our favourite restaurant. Well, some of us may need to wait weeks or even months for that to happen, with restrictions on restaurants likely to be one of the last measures to be lifted. But one restaurant in the middle of the Swedish countryside might have the answer, taking minimalism and social distance to extreme lengths. Claire Runacres has been finding out.
The pop-up restaurant called Table for One consists of a simple table and a single chair set out in a meadow surrounded by fir trees. There's no waiting staff. The three-course vegetarian meal, including drink, is delivered to the table using a basket on a pulley system from the kitchen window. The idea came when elderly relatives came to visit, but coronavirus restrictions forced them to be distant, as the co-owner Rasmus Persson explains.
We had to have them seated outdoors. This was March, it was kind of windy. But we made it fancy, you know, with a white linen cloth, and we served them through our kitchen window. And that's when we felt like, wait a minute, this actually is an opportunity, right? This is a way for us to start that restaurant that we've been talking about for such a long time.
It's solo dining, but it's not a lonely experience,
as guests are greeted with a letter written for them by a friend. The couple who run it say it offers the ultimate eating experience. No social distractions, just you and your food.
That was Claire Runacres. In the past few weeks, World Service listeners have been recommending songs that encourage people to comply with coronavirus restrictions like staying home and washing hands. Well, one listener, Peter from Liberia, has messaged us a song featuring the country's president, George Weah. So here's a taste of the track to end this podcast. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.